Hi, this is Melody Travers coming to you from Crazy Town. In this very special bonus episode, Rob gets to interview Sylvia Earle, the legendary ocean explorer and conservationist. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you want others to get the Crazy Town experience, please hit the share episode button and send it to your community, or drop us 5 stars. Now to the show.
Dr. Sylvia Earle is an internationally renowned oceanographer, marine biologist, and explorer at large with the National Geographic Society. She's the president of the Mission Blue organization and a tireless advocate for protecting the oceans and really all of life on Earth. I'm not going to take time to go through all the awards and recognitions that she's received over her career, but I definitely want to recognize her as a fantastic writer. She has a new book coming out in November 2021 from National Geographic called Ocean, A Global Odyssey. Sylvia, welcome to Crazy Town.
Thank you for having me on board.
Yeah, it's great to be in conversation. Sylvia, I've followed your work for a bunch of years, and it's crystal clear that you have a love for the ocean and a built-in curiosity about everything that lives in it. I was wondering if you can describe what sparked that love and curiosity. What got you going?
Well, I fell in love with the ocean when I was a little kid on the New Jersey shore. But when my parents moved to Florida, when I was about 12, the ocean was my backyard. So it was a very natural thing to go exploring and do what kids do, ask questions and want to know everything about everything all the time. And since the ocean was right there, I naturally began diving in, and I've been diving in ever since.
Yeah. I'd say that it's pretty clear you're a natural-born explorer. I mean, some of us get to the ocean, and then we can't get past the waves and end up turning into surfers, but you've turned into something entirely different. So, I mean, okay, you're a natural-born explorer. That's like you just said, you have this curiosity, you want to know everything about everything. You've done amazing things in the depths, making record-setting dives in pressure suits and mini-subs. I mean, what's it like to drop down more than 1,000 feet below the surface and explore a world that's just utterly different from the one we normally inhabit?
In a word, it's exhilarating, and everyone should do it. We live in the 21st century. Think of how many gazillions of people fly high in the sky, eating lunch, watching movies, taking naps. But how many have been even 1,000 feet, even 300 meters? That's not very far. And yet, only a privileged few have had the joy of being able to see what's there. And that's just the surface. And you think that the average depth of the ocean is 2.5 miles, about 4 kilometers. And the maximum, 11 kilometers, 7 miles down, which is as high in the sky as people fly when they fly across the continent or the ocean. And so it's baffling to be a witness to the greatest era of exploration in history through my lifetime, and to see when flying was once considered to be a rare thing for most people, now it's like getting on the bus. Well, the idea that flying high in the sky is something that people take for granted, and maybe someday access to the sea will be something that everyone can enjoy. I mean, not just the surface. Anybody can dive in and swim, holding your breath. But millions of people now use scuba. And it's exciting to see more and more. There are little submarines that people can get into and see what it's like where sunlight does not penetrate. And that's below about 1,000 feet. It's really dark all of the time, except for the flash and sparkle and glow of bioluminescence. Most of the creatures in the sea have some form of creating their own living light, like fireflies. But living light with glowworms and fireflies and a few glowing mushrooms and a handful of other terrestrial things, it's not common, but in the ocean, it really is. Sometimes at night, you can see blooms of bioluminescent microorganisms that just turn the ocean into a blue fire. With every crashing wave, you see this illumination that looks really wonderful.
Yeah, I'm getting the sense, you know, you use the word exhilarating to explore and see these things, and I can feel that in your voice and the way you think about it.
Well, the ocean, of course, when you think of what are the words to describe the ocean, it's powerful, it's beautiful. Most of the descriptive words that people have come up with describe the physical nature of the ocean. But the ocean is alive. It's like a living minestrone with all the little pieces. It's some living organism. Even on a cup full of water that looks perfectly clear, there are literally millions of microbes. It's a system like nothing else that we know about, at least anywhere in the universe.
Yeah, really amazing to think about. I hate to do this, but I want to take a turn toward the less inspiring. And you've done a lot of documenting of the evidence that the oceans and ocean life are suffering. I was wondering if you could provide something like a medical checkup or a report on the state of the seas.
Well, people ask me sometimes, well, what's the big problem with the ocean? And there are two things in broad strokes. It's what we're putting into the ocean. A lot of junk, a lot of material that we think that we're getting rid of, substances that we don't want next to where we live. So we throw it in the ocean. Sewage outfalls, where do they go? Into the sea. Whatever it is. Upstream, downstream, into the ocean. When our numbers were small, even 1800, there were only a billion of us. Now they're close to 8 billion. And more than just numbers, it's how we have accelerated the use of nature, creating more and more trash, more stuff, if you will. One of the biggest problems that people are aware of now is the amount of plastic that has been generated since the middle of the 20th century, and every bit of plastic ever formed is still around, either still in large physical chunks or broken down into microplastics and even nanoplastics. One of the great things about these synthetic materials is that they're durable. They last a long time. They don't just go back into their basic elements the way what we think of as, quote, organic materials tend to break down into their basic elements ultimately, or get converted into something else that is not damaging. But plastics just stick around. So I think about those old fishing nets in the 1960s that were for the first time being made of these light and durable, relatively inexpensive materials. So it was easy for fishermen to just let them go, not try to retrieve them or not spend a lot of time trying to repair them once they got damaged. The ocean is now clogged with the decades of accumulated fishing gear, and more all the time. So the loss, not just in terms of entanglement with long lines and nets and crab pots and lobster pots that, again, are largely made of these synthetic materials, they do a lot of killing. Deliberately, of course, when they're used to catch animals in real time, but then over decades, they keep killing and killing. So the thought is, not just the thought, but the evidence that has been gathered in recent times shows that as many as 300,000 marine mammals, whales, dolphins, seals, sea lions, sea otters, our fellow mammals, are killed every year just through entanglement and engulfing the junk that we throw in the ocean, mostly plastic, mostly fishing gear. So it's what we put in, but it's also what we take out. And it's particularly ironic at this stage of our enlightenment about what we're doing to the planet, cause and effect, how we are affecting planetary chemistry and planetary climate. And the ocean is really the key to the diversity of life. It's where most of life on Earth actually is, both in terms of its sheer volume, but also in terms of its diversity. So all these important programs that are underway to protect the diversity of life are somehow not accounting for what we deliberately extract from the ocean. Millions of tons of ocean wildlife taken that we market as seafood or as products. And there's a link to climate, a direct link, not only because the ocean captures and holds and distributes heat and has, through the currents, distributes cold as well. The sinking of cold water in polar areas. And if you go into the ocean, even in the tropics, and get below, you know, even 1,000 feet, let alone 1,000 meters, it's really cold. Yeah. It's that cold polar water that really maintains Earth in a in a habitable form for the likes of us. The distribution of temperature, the shaping of planetary chemistry and temperature. It's the ocean that really shapes climate. And we've largely been not putting that fair and square on the balance sheet when we talk about climate change and climate solutions. So again, ironically, we look at trees. We understand they capture carbon, sequester carbon. We give carbon credits for those, in some cases, that will protect the trees. There's an economic advantage that some actually have been enjoying if they protect the trees and other terrestrial habitats. But the ocean is where blue carbon, it's not just mangroves and marshes and seagrasses, it's those amazing, mighty, microscopic forests that do the heavy lifting in terms of capturing carbon dioxide, generating oxygen, taking the carbon that they capture through photosynthesis, and then delivering it through these amazing food chains, the nutrient cycles in the ocean that power the zooplankton, the shrimp, the tiny crabs, the little guys that in turn feed the middlemen, and then the larger creatures, including whales. So in 2020, International Monetary Fund commissioned a study that was reported out at Davos about the importance of whales because of blue carbon. Put a dollar sign on the value of carbon captured by the whales in the ocean, and they came up with a figure. They said it's on the order of $1 trillion, the carbon in the whales alone, that is captured by the phytoplankton, goes zipping through the food chain, and ultimately winds up in these long-lived whales that hold and sequester the carbon over decades, but then they also deliver nutrients back into the ocean and power the phytoplankton, and the cycle goes round and round. So, great, we got a number for whales. What about tuna? What about swordfish? What about all those creatures that we extract from the ocean and release their carbon, like burning a forest or clear-cutting a forest? We're taking the carbon out of the ocean, exacerbating the issue of carbon capture and release into the atmosphere. We're trying to come up with some great engineering solutions about actively pulling out carbon dioxide from the atmosphere to complement what the trees are doing naturally. But we've been just have blinders on when it comes to the ocean. So, you mentioned the book, The Ocean, The Global Odyssey. That's how I spent my pandemic year, if you will. Hunkered down, trying to look at as much as I could wrap my mind around, plus my decades of personal experience, but to see the latest information that we have. We've learned more about the world, about who we are, about where we've come from, where we might be going. But especially we have learned about the ocean since the middle of the 20th century, more than during all preceding history. And I had a chance to kind of kick back and literally dive into this important topic and try to translate it in a series of sections, like little stories, dozens of individual pieces that, taken as a whole, tell the story of the ocean. And so for me, it was just a wonderful opportunity to get caught up on the ocean and climate, what we're doing to wildlife in the ocean, and what we can do to turn things around.
Well, something that I really appreciate about the way you're talking about the ocean and the life in it, two things came directly to mind. One is you definitely think in systems and cycles and flows, which is the kind of thinking that we need to, I think, get out of some of the messes that we find ourselves in, that humanity is you know, the direction that we've pushed ourselves. The other thing that I really appreciate is you are talking about causes and rather than symptoms. A lot of times we see a problem and it's sort of like, well, let's just address the symptoms. Let's scoop the plastic out of the ocean or something like that. But yeah, if just doing that, you're not addressing the cause, which you talked about. You know, we're pushing into an overshoot situation where we have too many people consuming too much, polluting too much, and we've really got to figure out how to limit ourselves. So I really do appreciate that. I also, you brought up the book, and I do want to turn more in a bit to your process and intent in writing it. But I also, I gotta tell you about, I want to talk to you about a previous book just a little bit. Not going to force you to try to remember what you said in a 1996 book, but you wrote a book then called Sea Change, which I actually just stumbled across a copy of it because I used to work in the National Geographic building in D.C. And I saw it and I was like, oh, this looks great. And I was, sort of a young environmentalist at the time. And I got a copy of it. And I was at this career crossroads, actually, and I found the book. It was really influential on me. And what I still to this day distinctly remember is you gave this really deeply personal account about your dilemma with eating seafood. You described how you grew up on it, loved the taste, loved eating it. It was, you know, kind of in the culture of your family. But you recognized that commercial fishing was tearing up ecosystems and crashing the populations of the wildlife of the sea that you love. And to me, this brings up so many questions about culture, behavior change, trying to make your life consistent with the challenges that we face. I wonder if you can just describe your struggles interacting in a culture that's treating the oceans and the planet so unsustainably. How do you wrestle with that?
The cause for optimism is that the knowledge is there that wasn't there when I was a child, that so much has been learned that gives us the best chance that we will ever have to make peace with the natural systems that make our existence possible. We thought the ocean was too big to fail. We thought the world was so immense that nothing humans could do could possibly change its basic nature. But now we know that's cause for hope. Cause for despair is that we are so locked in to habits that shape our behavior. We have laws that reinforce bad behavior, if you will. It's legal. It's subsidized, it's encouraged globally to extract ocean wildlife on an industrial scale, even though there's evidence and it's all around us. We see the consequences on the land and we've begun to shape policies that are far more respectful of wild animals on the land. We've got loads of problems, loss of diversity, loss of forests. But there's a greater awareness by far about taking care of what we can see and feel and experience. But we have grown up with the attitude that wild animals, true on the land, but especially in the ocean, that they're free goods. They're there for anybody to take. no consequences for taking a fish. We have some rules and regulations, but mostly they are in place to favor, encourage, even subsidize commercial extraction of ocean wildlife. So there are big concerns about wildlife trade on the land, but the biggest wildlife trade currently taking place is life from the ocean, all wild, that we are marketing as if they will never run out, even though 90% are gone of many of the creatures that were there in abundance. As recently as the 1970s, we've seen a drop from then till now of 90% of the bluefin tuna, for example, and that trajectory is the same. Species after species. We're so good at catching, well, finding, catching, and consuming these wild animals from the ocean. And not just for food, but for fertilizer, for animal food, for chicken food, for cow food, even to feed to other fish like salmon farms. So we know plenty of evidence that this is related to what we're experiencing in climate. If we could just keep fish in the sea, keep trees in the forest, keep oil and gas and coal in the ground, we go a very long way towards stabilizing climate. But we have yet to really accept the reality. So I am optimistic because knowledge is our superpower. It really is. How have we progressed from where we were 10,000 years ago to where we are today? People learn things. They change as they learn. And they pass their new discoveries, new habits to the next generation and so on through not just decades or centuries, but over thousands of years. We have benefited from what our predecessors have learned and how they've changed their habits. So we don't go around shooting wild birds to feed thousands of people. A few people shoot wild birds or take them however they can. But basically, we respect our wild neighbors for reasons beyond pounds of something to eat. We have to get over that with the ocean and really see the way divers have coming to sea, because they get to meet fish on their own terms and see that everyone, like every bird, every cat, every dog, they're all individuals. They have societies. There's somehow this illusion that fish don't feel pain. I don't know where that ever came from. God, it's so contra-intuitive. It's against everything that I've ever learned as a scientist. Here's a whole category of animals, our fellow vertebrates, oh, by the way. They have eyes. Fish, like humans and other vertebrates, have a heart and a circulatory system, a backbone, a nervous system. There's so much that's so comparable, and yet we think they feel no pain? Like, come on.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the idea of knowledge as our superpower. I think there might be a corollary that we also have a lot of power of self-deception that way, you know, like we can tell ourselves all kinds of stories. But
well, we also have this power of empathy.
Yeah.
Empathy.
That is a definite deep truth. And even with animals, as you're talking about, I mean, maybe sea life is too foreign to too many people, and that's why we can come up with those stories. But if we got to know it better, yes, as you have, that empathy then has room to expand and grow.
And it's what makes us think of ourselves as special. We're not only human, we tend to be humane. We care for other humans, but we also care about other forms of life on Earth, whether it's, yeah, our cats and dogs and whatever, but we feel their pain, we feel their joy, we are able to just take ourselves to another place. We're not unique in that respect. Again, now we know, the more we know about the nature of other forms of life, what Jane Goodall was able to discover about our fellow primates by getting close, living with them for like 15 years, she got to see things and transform the way people began to look at other animals. But it's also, now we know, true with whales. They have families. They have empathy for others. They come to the aid even of other other species when they're... We see so many human-like characteristics that we value in other forms of life. So maybe there's cause for hope in that respect.
Yeah, I think so. I want to hang on to that thought for a minute because I do want to talk about hopefulness. But I also... You brought up this idea of knowledge, and there's a part of that that I want to discuss with you, especially because you've had, I think, an interesting relationship with technology and with, to explore the ocean and be able to get to the depths that you've gone requires a lot of knowledge, technology, engineering. And humans have this really complicated relationship with technology. I mean, those of us that are interested in conservation have used technological tools to discover all kinds of things and enhance our knowledge. You know, anyone in the world today can, you know, get on YouTube and find video from drones that that can explore shark behavior in coastal waters, for example. I mean, it's unbelievable the kinds of things you can see and learn. But at the same time, the technological build out and all the energy required to support it, that's part of what got us into this mess. I recently saw an article about the plans to do deep sea mining for metals that would be used in batteries to store solar and wind generated electricity. You know, that's of course pitched as, hey, here's the quote unquote green way to solve our energy problems. Let's mine metals out of the depths. And I always question the wisdom of doing something like that. So I'm wondering if you have some insights into our relationship with technology and how maybe we can gain some wisdom around what we do and don't do with technology.
This is literally the first time in all of our history that we've had it's the best chance we've ever had or ever will have. It's not too late to use the technology that now is available to us. Communication is high on the list. We can see patterns. We can relate what's happening on one side of the world to what's happening wherever we are and see that it all does come together. It's one interacting system. There is no away. And we couldn't see it when I was a child, and 50 years from now, it may be too late. It will be too late to do things we can do now. We're consuming the natural world that is our life support system. It keeps us alive. It's like eating the spacecraft on which we're flying through an unfriendly universe, and it's disintegrating around us. Why? Because we're consuming it. And nowhere is that more worrisome right now than you're mentioning the deep sea. Deep sea mining. In ignorance, we clear-cut rainforests without having the slightest concern about the loss of the diversity or the carbon connection, climate change, and all the other factors that we now look at. I wish we could put those rainforests back into place. I wish we could restore some of those desert systems that we thought were just wastelands. They're not. They're a crucial part of how life responds to varying conditions. Deserts can get by with very little water, but they're still thriving, important parts of what makes Earth a habitable place. And the ocean, mostly, it's the ocean that drives planetary functions. And it's the living ocean, not just rocks and water. And when you talk about those rocks in the bottom of the ocean, manganese nodules or the crusts, the hydrothermal vents, these are living systems. These manganese nodules have taken literally millions of years to form, but they're still forming. Microbial action, living microbes, are extracting minute amounts of the minerals out of the surrounding seawater. And gradually, over these long periods of time, to create these walnut-sized or fist-sized lumps that are loaded with some of the metals that, at least right now, we find them attractive, useful, valuable. But maybe 10 years from now, they will have lost their allure. We may have other means engineering solutions for batteries that don't require nickel or cobalt or the other elements that are found, the so-called rare earth materials that are not so rare, they're just hard to extract. We know how to get them from the land, and yes, mining is a messy business, but it's no less messy when you go into the deep ocean. In fact, it's worse, because there are these plumes that are generated both by scraping the sea floor to obtain these nodules or the crusts from seamounts or those metals that have formed or crusts that have formed around hydrothermal vents. It's really destructive, and you're going to clear-cut life that does not readily come back in the same way that it was before. We're talking time scales that we just can't wrap our minds around. That when it takes so long just for one little nodule to form, and we're talking about extracting from vast areas of the ocean, it's cause for me, almost for despair, that we know better. The knowledge is there, and yet it's all about the lure of quick returns.
Yeah, I, you know, I've written about this for quite a while, the idea that you can't run an economy that's based on perpetual growth and
correct
and the idea of profit over everything else. And, you know, that gets back to us deciding as a species, what is our place and where do we belong in this story? And can we limit some of the desires and the ways that we exploit nature so that we have a different relationship with it? And I really appreciate the work you've done in describing something that you love in a way that resonates with people so that we can start developing that relationship. You know, you've talked about knowledge as the superpower and helping to translate that for people to engender this love that maybe didn't exist before. I think that's one of our key outs, one of the ways that we come to alter our behavior and start treating things differently. I wonder if you know, I'd like to ask, I guess, for a little bit of advice, because you've had this really storied career, and you've seen some traumatic things. I mean, people can go on Netflix and watch a documentary with you and see things like, you know, bleaching of the coral sea, see fish markets that are, you know, sort of doing this industrial extraction. Let's be clear. There's a trauma to this. You've, you know, witnessed things that you love falling apart. And yet you go and write books that, you know, you've got a new book that's kind of like flying in the face of despair. So I'd like to see if you have some advice on remaining hopeful, maybe on self-care even, you know, like in the face of the trauma, how do you stay motivated? How do you keep working, keep fighting, keep trying and doing what needs to be done?
What should inspire hope in everyone is, look, we can't go back to what was. In addition to writing the Ocean, a Global Odyssey, I also did an update on the other book that you mentioned, Sea Change. It's a 25-year looking back and imagining how things were, how things are, and what are the reasons for hope. And mixed with the plenty of reasons for despair, wars and poverty and disease and climate issues, you know, we can actually tangibly, and I have witnessed a decline of my home planet. And it's not, you know, it's like geological change in one lifetime. And I could fall into despair, but on the other hand, look at the positive. There were no protected areas in the ocean when I was a child. Now, around the world, there is a movement to embrace at least 30% of all of the ocean by 2030, within 10 years, and at least 30% of the land. It's a tall order when you realize that only about 15% of the land and about 3% of the ocean has some really secure form of protection, which means 85% of the land and 97% of the ocean is kind of open for the kinds of things that people tend to do to exploit nature. So, the reason for optimism is when we embrace a place with care, land or sea, even in a few months, but especially in a few years, and the longer we wait, the more secure we make a place, take the pressure off. Recovery happens. Can't go back to what was, but we can make things better than they currently are. We have the power. You have the power in your backyard, if you have a backyard. If you have a big backyard, some people have acres. Some people have a small place. Some people live in apartments, but they have a community. They can work within the means that they have to restore health to their place on the land, to support national parks, to support planting native plants, to take some of the places that have been, they call them brown fields, make them green again. In fact, make them prosperous again. Have gardens, but look for native plants or ways to feed yourself if you have a little patch of your own. The joy of having a little garden to give back to the insects, plant native flowers and bushes and trees. The power of recovery, it works on you too. The joy of seeing something that was bleak and failing, when it begins to take on new life, it has an effect on you. It makes you feel, I can do this. And it actually does work with your own body. If you can change your habits in terms of what you eat and how you move, the way you spend whatever time you've got to maximize the impact on you. You can restore your health and then look around. What can you do to restore planetary health? Imagine if even a fraction of people around the world, but maybe why don't we all just do what we can? Look in the mirror. How do you use your personal superpower of knowledge or what you care about to make a difference, to make your body better, your mind better, but the world around you better too? It's the evidence. That's what gives me really a lift. That 10 years ago, I started this organization called Mission Blue, where around the world, individuals, champions, are working with their communities to go from wherever they are to get to a better place, ultimately with full protection of a part of the ocean where even the fish are safe. What a concept. Where that through caring, through actual positive things that people can do that are moving slowly but surely. And the thing is, we need to accelerate from slowly but surely, but to really, in the next 10 years, in your lifetime, whatever time you have, use it so that you can just feel that joy of making the world and making you better than you otherwise would be if you just go with the flow.
Yeah, thanks for that. I love that idea of letting nature do its work of restoring and how that can help us restore ourselves. And that's a lot of healing that needs to be done. And you're right, needs to be done very, very fast. Please, everyone, look for the book Ocean, A Global Odyssey from National Geographic by the fantastic Dr. Sylvia Earle. It comes out in November of 2021. Sylvia, I can't thank you enough for all the work that you've done, that you continue to do, and it's been a true pleasure talking with you today.
Thank you, Rob. I look forward to seeing you under the ocean. Let's go diving.
Yeah, I would love to meet you there. All right. Thanks, Sylvia. All the best.
That's our show. Thanks for joining us in Crazy Town. This is a program of Post Carbon Institute. Get more info at postcarbon.org.